Mr. Jewett, Reel 17. The Ohio was badly hit, you were saying, and you were there close to it when the trying to protect it from the air attacks.
That's right.
Did you see what happened to it over the course of the next period of time?
What happened, we gave what they call an umbrella barrage over the top of the Ohio, and to try and keep off enemy, because she was the one ship that we had to get through somehow. And how she stayed afloat, I do not know, because I don't know how many times she must have been hit, because you're not looking at a ship when you're in action. You're all over the place, you know, and you kept occasional glances now and again. You haven't got time to sit and stand and gawp at the Ohio or any other ship, you know. And things are just going on. The command of the fire control is coming from Terry Lewin, and all the play. You hear it in your headset, and you know exactly what's going on all the time, but you haven't got time to sort of concentrate for any more than a fraction of a second, you know, to really look at anything that's going on about you. In actual fact, it's difficult to describe what it is like, because I suppose we're all individuals. I suppose some lads were frightened, because some lads were frightened. There's no two ways about that. I wasn't on the gun deck, but somebody told me that somebody started to get a bit panicky on the X-gun, and the captain of the gun just gave him a swiped him one that knocked him flying, and that was the end of that. that was more or less the usual. And you know, in wartime, all these fancy proceedings about misfired guns are so hilarious. You go through it. If a gun misfires in action, you're supposed to wait 30 minutes before you can fire it again, because so in case you've got what they call a cook-off. That's like, you know, it's just selfing like that. By golly, they never worried about that. I said, if the gun didn't fire, it was open the breech and straight over the side with the projectile, the offensive projectile got thrown promptly over the side. There was no waiting 30 minutes for what they call a hang fire, you know. So that was the nonsense. But coming back to how you feel, you asked me how you feel. I was a very young lad, you know. I was only about 19 or something, and I didn't feel any great fear at all. I wasn't frightened at all. In fact, it was just a question that was clinical. It was rather clinical, getting on, sort of getting your, in my case, I didn't fire any guns, although I might have done sort of secondary sense, but I was just looking through a set of binoculars and getting my eyes on the targets. And that was the difference, actually. You don't you're so concentrating on what you're doing that it takes your mind completely off of what might happen. And in any case, I've always argued that I suppose it's true of soldiers, of sailors, and everybody. You never think it's ever going to happen to you, you know. All these people that get killed, they're all people who thought it would happen to somebody else. And as it so happens, that's the attitude you have. But you don't panic, and there's no panic at all about it. And that, of course, that goes on. You ask me if I was tired. You've got to say that again. But you don't notice it, because I'm not going to say that fear overtakes. I think there's a sort of responsibility. I don't know what the exact feeling is, the emotion is, that it's a sort of a responsibility. And I suppose soldiers and sailors, airmen, whatever, who know that there's a possibility of death, they don't think of the death side of it. They think it's you or him, and you're going to get him. It's as simple as that. And even though it's a knock-on effect, that's what I'm looking for. You might not have a bayonet in your hand, but you're still just as lethal as any soldier or anybody else behind a gun. I mean, I always reckon that some of the best jobs were the lads who were close range weapons crews, And they, I always envied them a little bit. That was the Ehrlichans. You know, the Ehrlichans are the pom-poms. And they, because they could almost see the whites of their eyes, and they could do something. They were actually behind the gun, doing, shooting. It's like a sort of a duel. Well, with the rest of the ship's company, who weren't behind guns, who there were supply parties and all sorts of things, and plotting parties, supply parties, radar, wireless, communications, people like me who were sort of looking through blinking block binoculars. We were, the fight, the ship was a team, a complete team, and the Ashanti was an exceptionally good one in point of fact.
In your particular employment on the ship, you'd be one of the first to see whether you actually hit a target you were firing on.
Oh yes, absolutely. you see your shells, particularly at night time. With tracer at night time, you see the ship's armament, the tracers going into it itself. In fact, we saw an E-boat explode, and we saw shells going into aircraft, and all the time you see that. But there's no sort of great rejoicing. You don't sort of do a knees up Mother Brown, because it just happens. It's part of the battle, as you were. And there's a sort of an atmosphere you can't describe. I suppose if there's one thing in life one can't describe, it's atmosphere. Everything from a royal wedding to the Royal Albert Hall concert, or even a football match. I've heard people say, I've seen the final on the television, but it's not the same as being there. Well, that is exactly how it is when we're talking about action. You can see it on the television. You can see guns firing and all that. The adrenaline, or whatever it is that flows through, you cannot describe that, because you know that somehow in your subconscious that you could be killed. You hope you could, or the ship could be hit, or whatever. You don't know what the future is going to hold. You're just cracking on there and doing your best. But we had good equipment. We had good ships, marvellous captain. Good grief, we had everything going for us on the Ashanti. As I said to you, we're so daft with the Tecton, the Scharnhorst and the Tirpitz together, actually, on that silly little ship. But it was a wonderful ship.
The noise of battle, that must have been...
Well, of course, that's right. The guns are firing all the time. And you hear... Actually, I was in the privileged position of hearing the control coming from the fire control, sometimes... aircraft bearing this, that and the other, it would be a bit, and you'd follow director, and then of course all the guns follow director and go on to the target, and then sometimes they fired independently, sometimes it was director control, and sometimes it was after control, divided control, all different control systems, gunnery control systems that happened, and you don't even think about that, you don't have to think about it, it's all taking part, but you can't watch mud. You can't watch it all the time. I mean, if you've got independent firing or divided control, you can't. You might have the after part of the armament on the starboard side, and the forward part of the armament on the port side. So you can't watch everything. There's times when you're completely you're just a communication. I was, and it was just a communication number, nothing more, nothing less. But I was always there. If the captain wanted to look through, I was his sight operator, and I was on it was there for him when he wanted, but he was invariably Captain Onslow used to have a seat, and he had a straw hat. You know, he used to get nicknamed the horse, because I know, it was most irrelevant, because he was much loved, I promise you. And he used to sit back and he used to watch the pomps, and he'd say, Hard a port. Coxton, yes, so many revs, 240 revolutions or whatever, and it was so cool and calm and collected. You'd think he was going for a walk down the Hyde Park or something. There was no, not even a raising in his intonation, and I think I learned that from him. When you get excited, not to put it into your voice, just to keep a level. You know, you keep cool and calm and level.
And that must have an effect on people around him.
Of course, absolutely. All the Brits was completely calm and collected. Admiral Burrows was there. In fact, on one occasion, we were battling away. It was a lull in the action, and Admiral Burrows was chatting to Captain Onslow, because they were both keen rugby fans. They were chatting away about rugby most of the time, from what I can remember. They weren't talking about the battle at all, but they were phenomenal. These were great leaders. Of course, you know, Captain Onslow became an admiral, and in his own right, and so did Terry Lewin. It was the end of my telephone. He became the admiral of the fleet.
Did you get into the job of picking up survivors?
No, we didn't. That was done by people who started. I think it was a tug or a Hunt class destroyer. The Hunt class destroyers were only half our size. They were about 1,000 tons. Marvellous for this kind of work. You know, they had a couple of twin 4-inch and good close range weapons. You know, Oerlikons and things like that. And they were really wonderful little destroyers. They were destroyers the same as us. We were 1,800 tonnes and they were about 1,000 tonnes. And the Ledbury was the one that I remember was, because she was up in Russia with us, and with the Lance, the Ledbury, and there was another one there, I can't remember. Oh, the Penn, that's right, the Penn was the other one that was there. And those two went alongside as we went further towards Malta. They went alongside at some period. They went alongside to get the Ohio was completely knackered, you know, and they got alongside to tow it. And I thought, well, I don't know whose idea. At that time I didn't. I do know now, because I've seen the picture, the Malta convoy, and I realised it was the captain of the Ledbury's idea. He's just died just recently too. His idea to tow it, get a destroyer, one of these Hunt class destroyers on either side, and they're equally balanced, and tow, use the engine, and they got, that was fantastic. It really was a wonderful idea, because she was vital to the war. I mean, I would suggest that had we lost the Ohio, that was the one ship we had to get in to get the petrol just for everything. I know it was getting shunted in by submarines and all sorts of weird and wonderful. The Maximan and the Fast Mine layers were trying to help Malta, but one merchant ship, one dirty great big merchant ship, carries as much as they can carry in about 20 trips. You know, it's unbelievable the amount of oil and supplies that one merchant ship can carry, actually, can survive a whole town, you know.
It was a particularly historical convoy, that, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was. We didn't realise it at the time, but like all, I say we were looking after ourselves, but there were so many merchant ships were hit and sunk, and there were absolutely beautiful ships. There were wonderful ships. I can't remember all the names now. I never bothered to learn them, but the Wamira and some likes. I think the likes. They were all there. Them getting sunk in that. The merchants they had. We sailors in the Royal Navy, don't make any mistake about it, had the greatest of respect and the highest regard for the men of the merchant navy in the we really did, because and rightly so, because they without them they were wonderful. That's the only word. They couldn't defend like they had DEMS ratings aboard. You know, defensively armed merchant ships. You know, they were DEMS rated. They were actually army personnel. You know, that went temporarily onto merchant ships, because we didn't have enough. The navy didn't have enough guns crews to man the merchant ships, but they were wonderful guys. There's no two ways about that. We didn't pick them up because we couldn't. You know, that was the reason we didn't. Not because we didn't want to, because we were busy sort of getting the convoy through to Malta. That was the prime object of that particular convoy.
At what point did you know that you were so close to Malta that you were through, in effect?
Well, the first, when you see a Spitfire, now you know, when we saw the first Spitfires coming out from Malta, that was it. We knew, because you know, for all we sailors used to take the Mickey out. We call the Brooklyn boys, take the Mickey out the RAF. Oh, how we used to pray for air cover, because without it made all the difference in the world. I mean, it's bad enough dealing with submarines and surface raiders and all sorts of that, but the air. But when we had air cover from the Royal Air Force, particularly, because they were good lads. I tell you, we used to. I think it was real. It wasn't any nastiness. It wasn't nastiness. It was just inter-service. We're better than you sort of rubbish. I suppose you get it in the regiments and the army sort of thing, really, or whatever. And you do certainly do on ships. I mean, we used to call other ships scruffy bloody ships. But the lads in the RAF, when we saw, as you say, when we saw the Spitfires coming out, we thought, God, we've made it. That's it. That was it. Because we knew that the Spitfires were going to would protect us going in, or the convoy going into Malta. Because we didn't go into the shanty didn't go right into Malta. We turned around, I don't know, a couple of miles out. We turned around because the Maltese took over then, and the Spitfires escorted her, and the Ledbury and the Penn, I think it was, alongside. Got her in very, very slowly. The convoy, she was going very slowly then. And there was about four ships there. And all these ships that went to Malta were cheered to the heavens, because I saw it on the films, but I wasn't there. They were cheered to the heavens by the Maltese, but we were the ones that got her that far, because we were the fighting escort. And it's a sense of pride that we did that, because it was...
How many hours were you, in effect, closed up at action stations?
Oh, God, I couldn't tell you. We talk about hours. We had days, not hours. You were closed up absolutely non-stop. From the time we left the Eastern Med, Algiers, we were closed up at action stations non-stop. We were action stations when the Eagle was hit, which wasn't long out, but the second day out, I think it was. It wasn't far out. We're talking about days. It was the same in Russia, and it was much the same on Atlantic convoys, but not as quite as tight, not as it was a question that it's the fighting efficiency of the ship. We had the sort of a half-baked action station. So I can't remember what kind of action station it was, but it was an action stations where. Sort of one from each party could go down and get some grub, some cocoa or whatever, some sustenance, to keep us at the guns. And that it wasn't a question of how many hours. You just lost count. I couldn't tell you. I couldn't answer that question.
But you yourself were in a job where you had to be there all the time. You were never ever relieved.
That's right. Nobody could relieve.
How did you cope with lack of sleep and this concentration.
I don't know. It's one of those things. I was young, So I don't know. If you asked me to do it now, I couldn't. I couldn't in a thousand years. Not now. But I honestly don't know that answer that question, because I wasn't the only one. I mean, there were lads on the. Of course, at night time it would happen on the searchlight, because the searchlights were controlled from the bridge. Did you know? The searchlight, a big powerful. 20-inch searchlight, or 24-inch, I think, a big powerful thing, which is in midships on the tribal class destroyer. In actual fact, it's what we call handrolic. It's where it's all gears. It's a rod gearing from the bridge down to the surface. Well, those lads were on searchlights. They were very, very good. They used to spend hours practicing to keep when the ship was rolling. Used to keep spot on. It wasn't gyro controlled like the guns. It was done all with hands, laying and training. But they were the same, and most of the ship's company are. I suppose some people could there's all lulls between the action. It's not going on all the time. It's just sort of when they come in, and it's in the lulls of the action that you take the opportunity to sort of go to sleep on your feet or whatever. And so, of course, after. I mean, when the poor old admiral, bless him, he'd been awake for about 5 or 6 days, I think, when he had 40 winks, and pillocks like me come and jumped all over him. I suppose he wasn't too far. I couldn't understand him being not believe, because there was nothing much for them to do, you know.
It wouldn't take anything to keep them awake, would they?
We thought that in Russia this happened during the war. We thought we had these what they call keep awake pills, and they reckon you could stay awake for 5 days on these pills. But you know, I never trusted the Navy altogether, because they used to give us this stuff in our tea, which stopped you getting sexy. And I often wonder if they gave you any of this, if they put any of this stuff in. You never know what these cooks did. You ever put in, and it slipped a couple of pills in to keep you awake? And I don't know that. You'd have to ask one of the higher command about that, because I didn't know. I was only a rating, you know. But it was only hearsay. In any case, it may not have been. May have just been, you know, gossip among sailors, you know. What they call a buzz, you know.
You were under air attack for a long time from German and Italian planes, presumably.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What was the most frightening of the enemy aircraft from the point of view of
the worst of all the aircraft, I think. Junkers 88s were a very fine fighter bomber, German fighter bomber, but the worst in offence were the Junkers 87s. They were what they call the Stukas. The Stuka dive bomber. Now, the system with the Stuka dive bomber is that they go up to a pretty good height, I suppose about 20,000 feet or something like that, up to a height, and they pinpoint their target, their particular target, and then they do a nosedive straight down onto the ship, and they pull out at the very last moment. And they started fitting sirens on these things, you know, that you could hear. They didn't make any. They wanted you to hear them, because I think the psychology of it was that the noise that they made would put off the anti-aircraft gunners. You see, it would sort of unnerve them. I don't think it ever worked actually, but they did that because it's terrible. As I say, at least the Shanty got at least two. One of them unfortunately landed on the blooming Ohio. They were pretty well almost suicide chaps, these Germans. They were very, very brave. I mean, don't make any mistake about that. These German pilots were extremely brave. But they were very frightening. If you ask me which was the most frightening, that on another time in the war, not at this occasion, but another time in the war, I was on another time in Russian convoys when there was a line of bombers coming in, and there wasn't just one or two, there was about 10 of them in line abreast, just about 40 feet off the water, 50 feet off the water, just coming in. And that is pretty frightening when you know each one of those has got a torpedo or a bomb or whatever, and that is pretty frightening. And but then again, you see all the ships firing and all the tracers going in, you know, they're getting it as well, you know. They're pretty brave people, these Germans. They had their job to do.
Was the dive bomber, was it inaccurate?
Oh, yeah, weapon? Not half. That was the trouble. they were pretty accurate because they were coming down at speed, and they had a pretty good margin of error, even with a destroyer. I mean, a destroyer is what, about the size of my garden, I suppose. It's I wouldn't say that they couldn't miss, because they did miss, but they had a good. I mean, they could. In some cases, they put bombs down the funnel. They were that accurate. They were plumb on the centre line of the ship. They dropped a bomb right down the funnel, so they were pretty. They were pretty accurate, you know. But the good thing was they only carried one bomb, or at most two, you know. But they're usually small ones, you know. I think it was about 1,000-pound bomb or something like that they carried. Not a lot.
The enormous number of aircraft coming in, it must have been difficult upon, you know, which one or number to target.
Well, that was not my job. That was Lord Lewin's. He was Terry Lewin then. That was his job. He would pick the target out, and then he would give an instruction Follow director, press a button, and then all the guns would follow him. So they all knew which target to, they weren't at sixes and sevens, so it was all highly organised, you know. Invariably, it was he would try and suss out the what he thought was the most vulnerable, the one at the front, or the
groups of warships had would gather together with a force name or letter. Do you recall what yours was in the Mediterranean?
Oh, this was well, my pennant number was G51. That was the pennant number of the Ashanti. But I think it was H Force. I think the whole of the group that we were in was H Force, and there was another force, which was Abu Sifrit, was in charge of the big ships and the cruisers. That was another part of the same. They were further away from it because, as I told you, and it's common sense, we couldn't afford to lose too many capital ships. You know, we'd lost. Malta was extremely costly in ships, and if we'd lost a battleship or something, oh dear me, there'd have been I think somebody had been shot or something at dawn. But as I say, they every destroyer. That's why we used to say why there was such. It wasn't animosity. It was just letting off steam, I think. While the sailor, we destroyer sailors thought we were so superior to the. The capital ships and that, because they couldn't go to sea without us, but we could go to sea without them. And I think it's actually when in Chatham Barracks after the war, when some of these boffins came down to give us gunnery instructors lectures, and they analysed all these losses, and the Japanese was the most astonishing. The way that the Prince of Wales and the Repulse was sunk. When they analysed it, you realised that it was the end of the battleship. Really, it was finished. Why they built the King George V after the war, I will never know. It was an absolute, and every sailor knew it. A half a dozen destroyers could sink any battleship because they can't. Divide the control and the destroyer can come in fast, and all its torpedoes, no ship can stand up to it. Sink the Bismarck, as you know, the Bismarck and the Tirpitz, the Bismarck was sunk.
It must have been quite a sight, though, when a battleship opened up with all its guns.
Oh, it's quite something, yes. I've seen it three times. I saw it at D-Day later on in the war, and apparently... I wasn't on the battleship, but apparently they've got anti-aircraft shells as well, because they haven't got a very great elevation, you know. They'd have to fire about 5 miles away, I should think. But I should imagine one of those 15-inch shells exploded in the air. I think it would just about upset one or two people. It would upset me, I know that much.